Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through J.W. Cole Financial, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Big Show, Your Money with David Hayes. Next week, this show will be replayed on Saturday. Thursday night will be kicked because of NCAA coverage here on the station. So we're going to bring you a show worthy of repeating. Tom Bunger, local estate planning and real estate attorney, will join me, friend of the show, of course, been with us a long, long time, talking about estate planning 101, just the documents that you need to put in place for each and every one of you, and just things to think about and how to approach things. Do you need a trust? Do you not need a trust? Are you going to be taxed on this inheritance or not? So we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff. I'm sure we'll have fun as well. We'll bring Tom in just a few minutes. Before that, let's do a little news of the week. Of course, always brought to you by this week, Mr. Tom Bunger, who's with me on my side, 332-9295. Can't believe I still remember that number after working there nearly 22 years ago. U.S. stocks again as the dollar rally wanes. U.S. stocks rose on Thursday as the dollar finally gave up a little bit of strength. Financial companies gained a number of points as banks got approval from the Federal Reserve to raise dividends and buy back some shares, which was big news. Of course, the early part of March, stocks have been slumping on speculation the Fed could soon raise its benchmark interest rate as soon as June. You know, living to 100 used to be just some actuarial punchline, like I want to live to 100, or do you think you're going to live to 100? But you know what? That might actually come true. For baby boomers that are heading into retirement in relatively good health and determined to stay that way, living to 100 is an increasingly and likely possibility. You know, the old notion was you stopped working the day you turned 65, you coast quietly into a fixed income stream, a pension, Social Security with modest investments, and the more likely reality was you'd just continue to do that and then die. Well, a recent survey found that 53% of folks that are approaching retirement expect to actually work a little bit in retirement. But if you're expecting to hit 100, you're going to have to change everything about how you invest and how you withdraw money. Folks, if you're 65 years old and you live until you're 100, that's a long time. So you would invest more like a younger person. That's the thought process behind this. So as you get into retirement, you don't necessarily want to pull the reins in totally. You got to have that money that's way out there invested for 30 or 40 years away so you don't get too freaked out when it goes up or down. You know, the money you need tomorrow, invest that differently than the money you need 30 years from now. Here's something from Newsweek. Genworth Financial is really struggling under the weight of long-term care costs. Here's an uncomfortable question. Who's going to pay for your mom or dad's or yours for that matter, home health care or nursing home? The answer is for 1.2 million Americans is Genworth, the beat-up giant of long-term care insurance. The CEO, Mr. McNary, is in a tight spot. He says it's getting tighter. Long-term care policies written in the past decades, they've all turned into a black hole for the insurance industry. Executives back then misjudged everything from how much elder care was going to cost to how long people were going to live. The results, these policies are costing insurers billions. Genworth is struggling to contain the damage and on Monday warned of material weakness in some of its accounting. To cope with the mounting costs on the policies, Genworth has been raising premiums again and again. Of course, policyholders are mad. And here's what happens. You know, you bought this 10, 15 years ago at 65. Now you're 80 and they're raising rates. You'd be mad too. But keep in mind, folks, that long-term care insurance is health insurance and it could and it probably will likely go up over time. And there's no quick fix for Genworth. It's posted two straight quarterly losses. The stocks fell by more than half in the last 12 months, including nearly a 6% slide earlier this week after disclosing that accounting weakness. And finally, the death of the millionaire next door. You know, the average guy out there can become rich here in America by working hard and being thrifty. I think it's still possible. That last week, the author of the best-selling book, The Millionaire Next Door, actually died in a car accident, Thomas Staley. Staley's 1996 book defined the prototypical American millionaire, not as the guy out there in a flashy suit and driving flashy cars, but the welders, the farmers, the mobile home park owners, the paving contractors. his where they're mostly their median income was around $130,000, but they had a median net worth of $1.6 million. They wear inexpensive suits and drive American cars, the book said in the voice of its punitive heroes. Only a minority of them, the millionaire next door, drove a current year modeled car. Doug Hughes brought that to me, and I promised him I would talk about it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Tom Bunger will be joining us live as we talk about Estate Planning 101. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Tom Bunger's joining me live in the studio. And Tom, you've been on this show many, many times before. And I think it's important when you're on just to kind of encourage people to start thinking about this and taking the time to plan. And, you know, we've joked about it many times before that more people spend time planning their vacations than taking time to plan out their estate. And I can attest to that because we were planning a spring break vacation. We spent hours on this stuff, Tom, and people just don't spend much time dealing with it, do they?
Or part of the plan for the vacation is doing the plan.
Well, a lot of people will plan right before they go on vacation for fear they might go down.
Get that call. I'm leaving on Saturday. Can you write this will for me?
It happens more often than you can imagine, folks. Estate Planning 101 with Tom Bunger. Let's take a little bit of time. And let's just talk generally, Tom, about what is estate planning, because, of course, for some, they might think that's shrubs and mulch, and on a beautiful day like today, I think we're all anxious to get that started. But
it's a lot more interesting to think about it that way.
Yeah, we're not talking about that estate planning today. What is estate planning?
It's the concept, David, of everything that I've accumulated during my life and where do I want it to go? Who do I want it to go to? How do I want it to go to them? Who do I want to make a difference to? Do I want to make sure that I don't derail where somebody may be going in their life by giving them some property and giving it in a way that it hinders them, or you know, sometimes people look at a child and say, well, goodness, I can share this with my child, but am I going to take away their motivation? They're a good hard worker. All of a sudden, are they going to change what they want? So it's the first thing you do is know what you have. And the next thing you start doing then, knowing what I have, where do I want it to go? And with that in mind, then start going through those items, start thinking about where it goes, what impacts it going to have on that person when they get it.
Mm-hmm.
If I give it to them, will they understand the value in it? Will they use it in a prudent and a good way, or will it be gone so quickly that in fact I've not done them any favor? If anything, I've set them back. So, if anything, knowing what I have, I'm sure you meet with people. I meet with people, and I say, "Well, do you have life insurance?" Yes. "Well, do you know who the beneficiaries are?" Well, I'm not sure. "Well, do you have a retirement plan at work?" Well, yeah. And the beneficiary? Well, I think. Well, the reality is those are large items that you work hard to accumulate, hard to put together, and that shouldn't be something. I'm not saying you got to have it memorized, but you ought to have some place at home where I know, say, "Listen, Tom, listen, David, I've got it right here. Here's what I have."
And later I'm going to talk about some of those investments, some of those IRAs or retirement accounts, life insurance that doesn't go through the will,
right?
As far as direct transfers go. But as we talk about all of this, Tom, I guess at the end of the day, they need some documents in place, and the will is the first thing that comes to mind. What is the will?
The will is the direction of where your property goes at your death. It is a written document where you put somebody in charge to carry out the directions and instructions that you put in that document. They are given authority under the will. It's filed with the court. The judge says, "Yes, that's Mr. Smith's will, and yes, Mr. Smith appointed you the personal representative of the estate, and you are charged to collect his assets and distribute them in accordance with the wishes that he has written in that document."
And before someone dies, it's common that they have a power of attorney. That's another document that is very crucial, very needed.
Yes.
Talk about that for a second.
Okay, let's remember, the will is a death time document. It doesn't have any effect until I have passed away. A power of attorney is appointing or identifying somebody to be able to help me carry out my lifetime business while I am alive. So it's somebody else, in essence, giving somebody else the ability to act in my name, look after things if I become ill and incapacitated, look after things because I'm going to be out of the country, look after things if I am in the military and I've been called up, I'm in the reserves, and the next thing I know, I've been called away. Somebody has to be there to make those decisions, to sign those documents, and deal with what's left, what's going on behind. So it's somebody you have great confidence in. If I'm going to be out and not able to deal with things, that's one thing. The other reality is if I get hit crossing 3rd Street next week and I'm out in a coma and I've got things that need to be done, I want to make sure there's a document in place so that my business can be tended to. Otherwise, the only alternative is to go to court and go before Judge Galvin and say, this person's incapacitated, we need a guardian appointed, and while they're quick and they're accommodating as best they can, you've got to work on the court schedule, you've got to bring in doctors. It's a slow process, and it's an expensive process.
Yeah, when you need something done now, that's the last thing you want to do. Now, that was the power of attorney takes care of mostly financial-related issues. What about the healthcare-related issues?
Healthcare is exactly what it says. It's making healthcare decisions when I can't. It is setting up an individual, a couple of individuals, a series of individuals based upon if they can or cannot do it, but to make medical decisions for you for medical procedures, for surgery, to admit you to a healthcare facility, to admit you to a rehab facility, to make those types of decisions when you can't.
Now, the end-of-life document, a lot of folks hear of this called a living will.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about a living will, because, you know, my joke is, and this is not a joke, it's a real story, and you've heard me tell this on the show before, and I've told it when I've talked in front of groups. My grandma Mary, she was well into her 80s, and she had nearly passed away a couple of times, but with no directive. No one knew what to do.
Right.
What was her wishes? And we sat down one night, and because everyone said, David, you're the only one she's going to listen to. So we sat down and I said, Grandma, you know, we really need to know what you want done if you're put in this position again. I mean, do you want them to keep you alive by all these machines? Do you not? I mean, do you want the girls to decide? What do you want? She just kept telling me, I want it to be God's will. And I said, I understand, Grandma, but I just want it to be God's will. When I finally got down to the root of it, Tom, God's will was that all of that machinery was there. That was God's will. The fact that all the doctors went to doctor school, as she said, that was God's will. And she wanted all used on her.
Yep.
So the living will can help give people that you love, that are around you, you've pre-decided what you want done.
Yes, and anybody out there listening to us, if they've been in the situation where they're dealing with a parent, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, and all of a sudden that doctor's having that serious conversation about this is where we stand, and while we can do this and we can do that, all we're doing is delaying the inevitable. And the question is, well, what would they want? Well, typically in that situation, they're not in a position to talk with you and tell you what their wishes are. So the living will is a thought out, while I'm healthy, while I'm competent and capable, direction of what I want to have when that situation arises. Now, the document's great. I also highly recommend that people have conversation with those individuals so that they know that is my wish. It's an uncomfortable position to be in, but the more you have prepared that person so that they are confident that they know your intention, your wishes, then you can make those decisions knowing that I have honored what they wanted done.
Yeah, you don't want them to have to interpret what you were thinking when you checked that box and signed your name. Have a conversation
It's not something we want to have a question about.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Talking Trust with Tom Bunger. Who is a good trust candidate? You know, a lot of folks think they just need a trust. And why? Well, because Joe has a trust. My mom had a trust, so I must need a trust. We come back, we're going to talk about who is a good trust candidate, and also when you start selecting things that go into a trust, what goes in, what doesn't go in, and if the trustee isn't yourself, who else could it be? We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. We got some new bump music, Tommy.
I like
it. That's my least favorite of them all, but it's still much, much better than it used to be. We're Tom Bunger, estate planning attorney, real estate attorney from Bunger and Robertson. Have been on the show many, many times over the last 12 years, believe it or not, Tom.
Whoa.
Hard to believe. I didn't think we were getting that old.
No, we're not.
That's what I think. We're going to talk trust with Tom Bunger. And Tom, of course, when people talk about trust, a lot of times they've either been scared into getting a trust before by going to some seminar or something.
Right.
Or their friend had the trust, their mom had a trust. I think when we first start talking about trust, what is a trust? And then also, who's a good candidate to have one?
Okay, first, let's think about what a trust is. A trust is merely a transfer of assets to a third party to hold it for the benefit of some beneficiaries. So somebody creates it, somebody holds it, and there's somebody who benefits from it. In simple terms, that's what a trust is. From an estate planning perspective, we use there are basically two types of trust. One which I create when I'm alive, and I actually transfer my properties, my assets into that trust so that it will function as a will. The difference being, for the trust to be effective, we don't need a court to bless it. We don't, in fact, that's the purpose of trying to create the document at that point, is to avoid the court. Or within a will, we'll create a trust because of the circumstances surrounding the beneficiary that's going to receive or benefit from that portion of the estate. Maybe they're underage, so mm-hmm. we want to hold it until they get through school. Or maybe they're horrible money managers, so we want somebody to hold it. But the concept is, I'm transferring assets to a third party, be it an individual, be it a corporate fiduciary, to hold the assets based upon the terms of the document and divvy up the assets and income to the people who I direct are to share in those benefits.
So I think you also described then who's a good candidate for a trust in many ways.
Yes.
People that wish that to happen. Now,
yes.
Some things don't belong in a trust, like retirement accounts. I know many times folks will have a trust and they come in and they'll say, I need to put this into my trust. Well, you can't really put an IRA or a 401k into a trust.
No. Again, if you're looking at a trust as a probate avoidance document, you wouldn't put it in there. The other realities, too, as you know, unless the trust is drafted, and even if it's drafted, it still can limit the ability and options to the beneficiary with that retirement benefit. Sure, we can do a stretch, and maybe that's something you want to do, but there's a lot of you give up some of the freedom, perhaps, in putting that asset into the trust.
So a person that has a trust, Tom, a lot of times think it saves them a lot of time, it saves them a lot of money, and it saves them a lot of taxes. And my experience is that none of that's really true, because for the most part, people don't know how to handle this. They get this trust thrown in their lap. They go see an attorney. They go see a financial advisor. They think when they set this up that it was going to save them a bunch of taxes, and that didn't happen.
Right.
And that's just simply, we'll go through that later on how taxes work now. But do you think that some people have a little bit of a misunderstanding of the purpose of a trust?
Yes, and part of that's because of the manner in which a trust is marketed. There are a lot of people, unfortunately, who market trusts by fear and telling all the horrible things that can happen in probate and making you think that the last thing I want to have happen in my life is my estate go through probate, which can be a problem. Or they make you feel insecure or stupid by not doing it, instead of just sitting down and trying to analyze what are my options, what is a trust right for me? Because if the bulk of my estate is by its nature a retirement account, life insurance, things of that nature, all of which are beneficiary designated, you don't need a trust to avoid probate. And now with the changes in the tax laws we're going to talk about, it's not needed to advance some of the for tax savings.
Yeah, and a lot of transfer on death designations, pay on death designations,
right.
Those are direct transfers
right.
as well. Do you see many folks, you mentioned this in your opening comments about estate planning, do you see many folks coming in now to you saying, I want to set up something that will pay out only if they act this way, or only if they go to school, or only if they make this much money, we'll match that much money?
Yes, I think people are understanding that they can create a trust and put some conditions on it. And that's one of the reasons you create the trust, is that I don't want to give them this lump sum, because first of all, maybe we know some experiences they've had and we don't want to encourage or enable that, you know, that activity, that type of behavior. Or I want to use it as that carrot. I want to encourage them to get that college degree, to attain that earning level, so that they've got to motivate them to do it, instead of really not removing the motivation. And sometimes I just need to protect them from themselves, or protect them from those who have influence over them, so that again, I sometimes want to use the analogy that while we cannot take our assets with us, we can leave behind our intentions, our values with those, and that so people do come in with that type of thing. I don't want them to automatically get this. I want them to be at this position, or if I've got a beneficiary that's had a substance or an addiction problem, I want to make sure that they're clean, that they're doing all this, so I'm not taking them where they've been able to work with it, but all of a sudden giving them the temptation because, goodness, now here's the dollars, so it's really not the problem.
Yeah, some people call that incentive trust. So yes. Let me ask you about trustees in those situations. I can imagine that if you have an incentive trust like that, you would want a fiduciary, like a trust officer,
right,
or someone that's not related to the party to serve in that capacity, because I can see that being a pretty tough situation. If I'm the trustee for a trust for my younger brother, and he's saying, I need money, I need money, I need money, and finally I say, just take it.
Right. That's the advantage of having the outside third-party corporate fiduciary. They're going to listen to the standard. There are certainly plenty of case law that's going to hold them accountable to that standard. They don't have that emotional tie. They're not going to sit across the table from that person at Thanksgiving or at the next family birthday party or get-together. So it's easier for them to look in and exercise judgment and say, no, that's not what this was entitled for. The other thing, as you know, is within that document, we can create a trust advisor. They're not making the decision, but I can leave behind somebody with some family understanding, some explanation, or giving additional information to that trustee so they understand. And when this individual who created the trust set this up, this was their concern. The decision you're making would be one they would be making if they were there, just to give them some personal idea
insight,
about why we did
right.
it.
Exactly. That's a great idea.
Exactly.
And lastly, before we take a break, a lot of folks, Tom, will come in, sit down with me, and start talking about these ideas.
Right.
And I have to have a tough conversation with them many times, say, you don't have enough money.
And I think that's the other reality that I have seen over the years that I have been practicing law, is we would say, we're going to set this trust up, and we have these options. The reality is now it's hard to find people that will take trusts of $100,000 or $200,000.
Sometimes even $500,000.
Exactly. And as that area of service has consolidated, the options for getting the corporate fiduciary has been harder and harder to find.
Maybe an opportunity, folks, for someone out there that wants to do that for a living on these smaller trusts. I'm always looking for an opportunity. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more with Tom Bunger. We're going to start talking taxes and the importance of having proper beneficiaries on your accounts. We're also going to talk about a little case scenario that I had come up this week when someone said, hey, my dad has a bunch of cash in the bank, and when we inherit this, I'm assuming we're going to have to pay a bunch of tax. Well, I was able to say to him, no, you're not. And we're going to talk to you about why that is the case. We'll be right back, folks. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Okay, that's my second. No, that's actually my first worst bump music back. The last one was number two. There's some really good ones. Really good ones.
They're coming up, huh?
Jim did a terrific job of putting some new bump music in that modernized the show somewhat, as we want to be hip and cool, I guess, on the show. Tom Bunger is my guest, and he is, of course, a partner with Bunger & Robertson over on College, 4th and College. Been there a long, long time. I worked there in college, didn't I, Tom?
You did indeed.
Had a lot of fun.
And we've survived.
You did survive. I had so much fun working there, and being around you guys was just a real character builder for me back as a young guy. Just kind of set the example of what professionals are supposed to act like, and also sometimes not supposed to act like, but which makes it fun.
That's right.
That's what makes it fun. Tom Bunger, he's an estate planning attorney here in Bloomington. And Tom, as we talk about taxes and beneficiaries, I want to first talk about how the tax landscape has changed significantly over what I think people have perceive it to be in the area of a federal estate tax, Indiana state inheritance tax, and then finally the income tax.
Exactly. First, the Indiana inheritance tax is no more. So there is no longer an inheritance tax due to the state of Indiana. Exemptions had raised quite a bit, and the tax was being phased out. But 2 years ago, the legislature passed the bill, and it's gone, which means we don't freeze joint accounts. I don't have I don't have to worry about I'm not going to be able to get to this money. I don't have to go to the assessor's office and get a consent to transfer. Those accounts are free. There's not a hold on them. It doesn't make any difference who the account's going to, if it's a joint account, whose name's on the account. No longer is there a tax due. Consequently, there's no longer a hold.
Now, if someone's account is in their name only.
Okay. If it's an individual account, if I'm going to open an estate, I'll have access to it. If it's an individual account but the total gross estate is under $50,000, I can get access to that account, that financial asset, 45 days after the date of death by an affidavit indicating that I'm the proper person entitled to that account, basically indemnifying the asset holder, the account holder, mm-hmm. if they give it to me. So 45 days after, without having to open an estate, get to that account.
Now, the federal estate tax, back when I first started in the early 90s, if you had an estate that was greater than $600,000, then you were subject to federal estate tax.
Right.
And an estate included, you know, everything.
That's right.
Plus life insurance proceeds. It didn't
retirement
take much to get you over $600,000.
Right. Right.
Then it went up to like $1 million, and then it went away. And then, you know, so Tom, give us the scenario, the story of where the federal estate tax is now.
First, David, put it in perspective. When I first started, the exemption amount was $60,000.
Now, we're not going to have this challenge of, you know, who was poorer
who
growing
was poor,
up.
I understand. No. But the bottom line is the federal estate tax exemption is now in excess of $5 million per individual. And when they changed that, they also made it portable, which is to say to a married couple, but prior to that, anything that went from spouse to spouse was exempt from the tax. But my exemption did not go from spouse to spouse. Now, so long as I dot the I's and cross the T's, that $5 million figure is transferable to my spouse, so effectively we can transfer over $10 million and not incur any federal estate tax liability.
So for practical purposes, folks, most of you listening to this show do not have a federal estate tax problem. Tom, as we talk about federal estate tax, let's now talk about gifting, because that's another area that people get all screwed up.
Sure.
I hear it all the time. My mom gave me $14,000. And you ask why? Well, she wants to get money out of her name.
Sure.
The great idea. Two, that's all she can give before I have to pay taxes. Tom, explain this thing for once and all.
Okay. Well, first of all, $14,000, you're right. That's the annual exclusion that I can give from somebody, and there's no gift tax return due. The other reality is, too, that other thing that's confusing to the person who receives it is they think someplace I've got to report that on my income tax return. It's a gift. It's not earned income. It's not a deduction to the parent who gives it, and it's not taxable income to the child who receives it. It is a gift. If it's in excess of that $14,000 amount, and I don't have a spouse to, let's not complicate it, we'll say we're going to split it with a spouse, if I as an individual and have nobody who can join in with it give you $15,000, the law would say I have to file a gift tax return on April 15th of the year following that gift. I would use my $14,000 annual exclusion and have a $1,000, quote, taxable gift. The tax is actually placed upon the donor, the person who gives it. Again, recognizing that this $5 million exemption we've got for federal estate tax also translates to lifetime gifts. So I will use up part of my $5 million to give the $1,000. But the bottom line is, it's not a deduction to mom who gives it. It's not taxable income to child who receives it. It is a gift.
So I have $250,000 to my name.
Yes.
That's my total net worth. And I say, Tom, I'm going to give it all to you. And
yes.
I give it to you.
Yes.
I file a federal gift tax return that simply says I gave more than $14,000 to you.
Yes.
So I still pay no tax because there's a $5 million federal gift tax exclusion.
Exactly.
So I think that's the basics of this thing, is that if you have less than or will have less than $5 million as an individual, you can give it all away. You just have to file the document.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the other side of that coin is it depends on what that asset is I'm giving away. Because remember, if I give an asset that is a capital asset appreciating in value, when I give that asset, When I give that to you, I also give you my basis. So when we talk, your example was giving cash. Yes, there's not a consequence. But if I give you the $500,000 farm that I bought many years ago for $50,000, I've also just handed you a $450,000 capital gain. And so that's why with the elimination of the Indiana inheritance tax, it makes some sense to at least consider holding on to that capital asset, because you still get a stepped-up basis in that asset when it passes from parent to child, which wipes out that $450,000 gain.
So basically, the cash is cash, no appreciation there.
Right.
Basis is basis. I give the $50,000 cost to my child.
Right.
Much better off waiting until I die, because they get it at $500,000. They can sell it, pay no tax.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing, folks. If you're, and I mean, everyone gets this messed up. Everybody. They don't get it. They don't understand it. In fact, when I teach these classes, even the Rejuvenate Retirement class we're teaching right now at Ivy Tech, I always ask, how many in this room believe that if you give more than $14,000 away today, that you or the person that received it is going to owe some tax?
Right.
Everybody raises their hand.
Man, yeah.
And when I tell them the truth and the story behind it, they're all like, really? And they still don't believe me. So I have to talk about it over and over and over. But it's insanity, because I continue to get the same result.
Yep.
We're going to take a break, Tom. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about taxes on those things that you haven't yet paid taxes on, and the importance of beneficiaries. And then also, we're going to talk about information in the time of confusion. I've been experiencing some interesting situations over the last month that sort of inspired me to talk about this. So we'll have time for sure to give you a little inspiration to write things down and talk about things. So we'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. J&S Locksmith, where you'll find everything for the residential or commercial outdoor technician. J&S at 508 West 17th Street in B-Town. Tom Bunger is my guest. We're talking taxes, and I want to continue on this real quick, Tom. You know, there's no Indiana state inheritance taxes. For most people, they don't have to worry about federal estate taxes or giving away cash while they're alive. We talked about having a stepped-up cost basis on appreciated assets if you give those assets away too soon. But let's talk a little bit about income taxes. There's trillions of dollars in retirement accounts. Trillions.
Yes.
And for most people, that's their largest asset.
Right.
In these days. That money has never been taxed. There's a big mortgage against it. It's the tax man. It's never worth what you quite see on paper, because
right.
if you cash it all out, it's worth a third less.
Right.
How do people deal with that issue, Tom?
Well, I think that's an important point to make, that there are two taxes, and just because I receive the asset and don't pay a federal estate tax or pay an Indiana inheritance tax doesn't mean it doesn't come with income tax attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's deferred income. And when it comes out, it's going to be taxed. And so part of that is in this record keeping you and I talked about, is for people to have all that information so that we know, is it a Roth? Is it a regular one? But the bottom line is, if in my retirement account it's made up of assets that an income that's all been deferred, as it comes out, we're going to have to pay.
Yeah.
You don't get a stepped up basis in that retirement account.
And of course, right now, many of those can be set up as an inherited IRA and
right.
taken out over time. That's why it's so important that you have proper beneficiaries on your accounts,
yes.
right, Tom?
Yes, and that's one of the changes that people may not have taken advantage of early on. The only person who could do a rollover on an IRA was a surviving spouse. And now, basically, anybody who's named on the IRA has the ability to roll it over. They've got the option to take all the cash. But you think about being able to roll that into a lump sum beneficiary IRA, continue to grow tax-free, and take the money out over time enables me to maintain the engine that's growing it, and take it out in a smaller amount, and maybe intentionally make sure that I don't change an income tax bracket when I take it out in a year when I've got less income here. Maybe I can pull a little bit more out, so I've exposed it to the income and I'm a little bit free to have access to use it.
You know, people know after they do their estate plan, I know where my will is. I know I'm proud. I finally got it all done. But Tom, like you said earlier, a lot of folks do not know anything about where their beneficiary forms are, and
right.
that is the will of that money. They need to know where it is. They need to keep it updated. They need to mesh it with the rest of their wishes, because, again, here in America, trillions of dollars in retirement accounts.
Or they have no clue on how to change it. And they think they do it if they call the people. They think they do it if they come into your office and say, I want to change this.
Right.
It's not a call. It's not a talk to somebody. I mean,
An address change.
No, you've got to complete their forms, and you need to get an acknowledgement back from them that the change has been made.
Great advice. Hey, well, let's talk real quick about information in the time of confusion. I recently was able to counsel with a lady my age who lost her husband not too long ago. And it really shook me. You know, as I thought about my own life, I went home and talked to my wife and said, hey, if I just didn't walk through the door tonight, if I died on the way home, you know, would you know what to do? And she said, I would have no clue. Now, over the years, we've talked about things, you know, call this person, do this person. But information in a time of confusion, you know, your world's been turned upside down. You know, 70% of Americans, they don't have estate plans, according to AXA. And the topic of estate planning, you know, we encourage people to, like we've been talking about here, plan for incapacitation, death. But unfortunately, the focus of most estate plans begin and end at the execution of documents and the proper titling of assets. But we fail to ensure that our families know what kind of decisions need to be made once we're gone. They don't have the adequate information. They Right. don't know where our assets, liabilities, intentions. I mean, for example, how many kids out there know where their parents want to be buried? Or how many pallbearers there should be, or who they want the pallbearers to be, or where their passwords are for their computers that hold all that information that you need to manage their affairs. I mean, you might be reluctant to discuss this tragedy of your death or disability with your family, but you're probably less apprehensive about writing it all down. And that's the idea of this concept called the family love letter. I mean, fundamentally, estate planning is not about the dead and the avoidance of death tax. Instead, it's more important about providing a legacy for the living, Tom. I mean, that's really what it's about, directives and all this.
Exactly. And it's the people, and it's part of my practice. I meet with people after they've lost someone, and they're struggling. They've been in the hospital maybe for days, and then they're faced with a whole nother situation of, who do I contact? What do I do? But if you take that time to have that, and you don't have to share it, you just got to create it so mm-hmm. that they know. And you mentioned, and I appreciate, the passwords. How many people today have, you know, you got to be careful where you put it, but the reality is, how do I get to this information? Well, if the password's not known, or I don't know where to get the password, all of a sudden the ability to get the information is difficult, and all that does is raise the frustration level and make a difficult situation harder. So having that information organized, having it someplace where everybody knows, mom and dad always kept this in the bottom drawer here, or it's someplace where it's safe, where I can get to it, is an extremely important step to take.
And you're looking at this document. They call it, it came from AXA, and it's called the Family Love Letter. It's 38 pages long, and I'm going to get Tom a copy as well. And I promised my wife that I was going to fill one of these out, and we were going to put it somewhere. And not just about, you know, retirement accounts and you know, all the things that we have out there, you know, debts that we owe or partnerships that we're in, you know, but it also just some things like how do I want to be, you know, things I want talked about at the funeral.
Yes.
I mean, who, where do I want to be buried? I mean, I'm looking through this, Tom, and there's just a lot of just touchy-feely things that you wouldn't have the chance to tell someone, you know, unless maybe you were terminally ill and you knew you had some time to talk to people, because unfortunately, folks, that's not the timing that everybody's on.
And the other reality too, David, as you alluded to in your opening segment about, as we continue to live longer and second marriages become more a common set of circumstances, the emotions that happen at the death of after a second marriage situation where we've got two families, two blended, we've got the children from the first marriage, the surviving mm-hmm. spouse who may have been together with this person for 15 to 20 years, and all of a sudden, you know, what do I want done at the funeral? Who's the person that's in charge? How are we dealing with all that?
Wouldn't it be nice to pick up an instruction manual?
Yes, it would.
Just flip through it.
And it would solve a lot of problems that I've seen people experience over the years.
So my offer to any of you out there, I got these free from AXA. If you want one of these booklets, I'll be happy to leave one for you or send one to you. Just shoot us an email at cfci.us, and I'll send you the booklet. The only thing I ask is that you promise to fill it out. We're going to take a break. Folks, come back, wrap up the show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. There we go. Now, that's the kind of music I like coming back. Let's just go with that one every single time, and then I'll be happy. Tom Bunger has been my guest. Thank you so much, Tom, for being on the big show, as always. We usually have you on once, maybe twice a year. And you know what, folks? I can tell you that we have to do things in repetition. I've been doing this for 12 years. We've been talking about a lot of the same things over and over. But we're not all getting it, so not everyone listens to every single show, and that's why we have WGCLRadio.com. You can go there and check out this show or any show that we've run in the past. This show will replay on Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock, and will for the next two Saturdays, as next week is spring break, and I'll be with my family on a what seemed to be long when you look at it on the calendar, but I know it will feel short once I get there, vacation, so looking forward to that. So we'll be back the following week, and we're going to be talking about how to properly insure for your long-term care. You know, there's millions and millions of people that are facing this every single day with their loved ones. How do we pay for long-term care? And I don't want my kids to be burdened like my parents, and I'm not saying are burdening me, but you don't want to be a burden on your kids. So you want to properly prepare for this and properly plan. So we're going to be talking about that in just a few weeks. It'll be here before you know it. Just a little disclosure that I have to read, that I am and J.W. Cole Financial or Comprehensive Financial do not provide tax or legal advice. So, of course, and I always encourage you to do this. Always consult your tax advisor or legal counsel before making any decisions or regarding your specific situation. Because, Tom, this is for general informational purposes only.
That is correct.
It encourages you and educates you and gets you out there to be able to talk to your financial professional. And a little update on the book, Today's Guide to Retirement Planning, a resource for adults age 50 and older. We wrote it. It's done. Tom's looking at it. It's my only copy. And really proud of it. It's about 156 pages long. It should be out on Amazon in about a week or so. And then I think they're charging $14.95 for paperbacks and $3.50 for ebooks. I have no idea how much of that I get. No idea. Not even sure if I get any of it. I'm just happy to see it in front of me. It's a pretty blue color with a little gold trim. Pretty killer quotes in the back from Ed Slott, the founder of IRAhelp.com, and the Wall Street Journal lists him as the country's IRA expert. And, of course, our good friend Mary Beth Franklin, who is scheduled to be on the show sometime in June, and she's now the contributing editor of Investment News and, of course, the past editor of Kiplinger Magazine. So, Tom, any last remarks, encouraging comments for people listening to the big show?
Just plan. Get everything. Be in a position of knowledge. Knowledge gives you the opportunity to make the right decisions. Leaving it to circumstance leaves it all to chance, and you've worked way too hard to accumulate those things that you have to leave it to chance.
And I tell people too, Tom, not doing anything is making a decision.
Oh, it is. You're letting the state of Indiana decide for you, and you're letting situation decide.
70% of Americans have not taken the time to do this. It's not that hard, folks. And think of it in 5-year increments. Don't think of it like, you know, I'm 50 years old, and when I'm 90, just think of it, well, by the time I'm 55. You can always change it. It's a living, breathing process that we all go through. So, again, thanks to Tom Bunger for being part of the show. Hope everyone has a great week. I'll talk to you again in a week and a half. This has been Your Money with David Hayes. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Guest opinions on this show do not necessarily represent those of the radio station, David Hayes, or CFCI. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana.